The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Sitting in front of me is an actor many of you will know from his work in movies, whether it's Batman, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, 28 Days Later, the list goes on. But he's also a notable theatre actor, and you'll be able to see him soon at the Galway Arts Festival when he opens in a new play by Enda Walsh called Ballyturk. Cillian Murphy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you are good to come in and do this because you don't like interviews, although radio's less painful, is that right?
Yeah, it's good chat. I don't mind a chat.
You say Ballyturk isn't really a play with a plot. You can't really describe it easily.
No, it's not a sort of a what's it about play, really. I mean, people who are familiar with Enda's work, I think, will know his, the way he writes. And this, I think, in terms of the form of Enda's work, I think he's really pushing it in this one. It's a very important play for him, I think.
We were talking just before we came on air. It is, you know, in one way you could talk about Enda Walsh's work and it would sound like, you know, he's dealing with, you know, depressed themes or, you know, bleak themes or whatever. But there's an energy and excitement, and he is so very good on male psychology, male distress, males under pressure.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's it. It's he likes to see what happens to the sort of human psyche when you put an enormous amount of pressure on it. And he's very interested in behaviour. And I think this is a play about that and about friendship and about death and all those things. But also, there should be a few laughs in there.
Michael Murphy and Stephen Ray are in it as well, is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah, Michael and Stephen. And, I've known both of them for a long time. I've worked with Stephen in film. I've never worked with him on stage. And Michael, I've been a huge fan of for many years, and people will know his work, you know, at Barabbas over the years, and he's a phenomenal actor. And so it's a nice dynamic, I think, with the three of us there.
So Ballyturk opens at the Galway Arts Festival, and then it will be coming, so that's in July, it'll be coming to the Olympia in 7th to the 23rd of August, then the Opera House in Cork, and then you go on to the National Theatre in London. You like working with Enda, of course, don't you? You got your first break in his Disco Pigs, isn't that right?
That's right, yeah, a long time ago now. Yeah, he cast me in that play back in 96.
He has a great description of you. Like, even then, you're an unknown, but he talks about your presence, obviously the eyes that get commented on, the blue eyes in every interview. And also, he says you were cocky. Were you?
I'd like to describe it as the confidence of youth.
Do you look back and blush, or do you look back and admire the swagger that made you march in there? And
well, I think the thing was, you know, back then, we really, really, none of us really knew what we were doing, but, you know, so it kind of made us a bit fearless. And certainly I didn't know what I was doing. And I didn't know the quality of that play and the quality of the part that I had got, you know, and how lucky I was to do it. So that was probably a healthy thing, because you went at it with fierce energy and fierce commitment. And then you kind of realise the reality of actually being an actor, and that gigs like that don't come along all the time. So I was very, very lucky to start with something like a play like that, you know.
Because you were going to be a rock star, isn't that right?
Well, I prefer a musician. I wanted to do music was my thing, you know, and that's what I wanted to do. And I was very curious about theatre, but I had no real ambition to be an actor at that point. And then it just sort of became a reality, or became an option with the play, and the play did very, very well, and it became like a more sort of appealing thing than the music. Or I guess I felt that there was a ceiling on my our abilities as a musician and with theatre and acting. I felt like that there was, I had a lot more.
You felt something in yourself when you started acting, did you?
It became a more important form of self-expression, I suppose, than the music did, and it sort of. Yeah.
And were you full of notions about what you wanted to do with your art, or was it simply that you wanted to perform?
Yes, it was that. I just wanted to perform. And funnily enough, I've always felt the stage to be a kind of a safe place for me. You know, I've always felt secure up there. Again, probably lucky, because I was doing great writing very quickly, which, you know, is you're very lucky to do that. But I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed that performance of getting under the skin of someone else. for some reason.
And also with a stage performance that you can kind of live in that character for a couple of hours, whereas in the movies, it stops, starts, stop. I mean, how did you get into the movies? Was that an ambition, or was that, you know, you're an actor going for auditions and some of them happen to be for movies?
Yeah, it was that. It happened very slowly and gradually. I mean, I did theatre for about 4 or 5 years in Ireland exclusively, and I was, you know, I worked with Druid in Galway quite a bit as well, and I learned a great deal from working with great actors and great directors. And then I got a little parts in short films and then slightly bigger parts in feature films. But it was, yeah, very gradual and slow, and so I was learning all the time.
And did you, I mean, because you seem, when you look at the kind of work that you've been associated with, are you choosy about what you do, or have you just been lucky in who you got to work with? You seem to have, do you have clear ideas about directors you want to work with or particular parts you want to do?
Well, for me, it always starts with the script. It's always been the thing. And I suppose because the fact that I started with something like Disco Pigs, it set the bar quite high. So I've always been interested in the script first and foremost. And then obviously if there's a great director, that makes the decision easier. But I think you can't make a bad script really any better. You know, it has mm-hmm. that's the foundation for the work. So that's what I've always decided.
And you've worked with some pretty impressive directors. I mean, Danny Boyle, Christopher Nolan, Ken Loach, Neil Jordan. Do they bring out different things in you? Do you find how have you found yourself growing working with different directors?
Yeah, every director is different. You know, they all have their unique way of working. But the best ones I've found have always been very collaborative and very open to ideas. So, yeah, I've been really, really lucky. But they're all different. You learn different things from each one.
You weren't necessarily a shoo-in for The Wind That Shakes the Barley, were you? Did you have to audition for that a number of times?
Yes. I mean, Ken does that. He makes everybody go through quite a rigorous...
And you really wanted that part. That must have been a bit kind of, why is he making me do this again and again?
Yeah, I'm from Cork. Come on.
I can do the accent.
I can definitely do the accent. Yeah, but that's the way he works. He's very clear about the type of actor he wants for the part, and so there's a very long process of getting to do. But I just enjoyed that process. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of improvisation and stuff. To actually just do that with Ken Loach, who's such a legend, was a real gift.
And you were determined to work with Neil Jordan as well, were you?
Yes, that came about through. I knew that there was a script for that book, Breakfast on Pluto, which is one of my favorite books, and I'm a huge Pat McCabe fan. And I kind of, I guess I pestered Neil a little bit, and I was like, Neil, you better make this or I'm going to get too old. And so we managed to make it, yeah.
You talk about getting too old. You're what now, 38, 37?
38.
And you've talked about, because, you know, again, you've got these kind of cinematic looks. You haven't seen that picture of that guy with the mugshot, have you?
No.
Actually, I must show you, but he looks quite like you, I
Does
think,
he?
In some way.
God.
But anyhow, but you have, you know, one of these things about your looks and all the rest and the kind of attention you would get for that when you start doing the movies. You seem to be pretty embarrassed by it all. You don't like it.
Well, it's not something I have any control over, really, is it? You know, and you hope that people judge on the work, and that's what I've always tried to do, and it's the only thing I'm really interested in, and so it's... That's a way off. Right?
But it's an advantage, obviously, for something like the movies.
No, I don't know if it is or not. It's just embarrassing talking about that stuff, really. I mean, you know, you just have to do the work and bring some sort of conviction and honesty to it, and then do the next
And you've
job.
Said you're already at the age of 38 getting getting offered dad roles. Is that right?
It's nice to get. I mean, I'm a dad myself, so it's nice when you get to play a dad because I have some experience in that field at this point. So yeah, I mean, I think as you get older, it naturally has to change the types of roles that you get, and that's interesting.
Does it open up, particularly if you're a bit kind of fed up with the whole kind of matinee idol looks kind of thing, does it open up more roles and more diversity, which you as an actor would find more challenging than just being, you know, the male lead? You know,
well,
not that
well,
you've ever just
is,
been the male lead.
I mean, they say it takes 30 years to make a good actor, and I kind of believe in that. So I'm doing it for 20 years. So it's the next phase, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's a continuous journey, like, playing different parts and exploring new parts of your mind, I suppose, and that's what you're trying to do.
You mentioned being a dad. You have two boys.
Yeah.
And you enjoy that.
Yeah, they're brilliant. Yeah.
But they're all, you don't have much of an online presence because, again, a lot of actors and people who are performers now, you know, that they, you're supposed to be a brand, you're supposed to have an online presence and be able to offer yourself, you know, an X number of followers to whoever's interested in hiring you. Again, that's not something you're hugely into, is it?
No, I just like, I like the old acting, really. That's what I'm, that's my main concern. You know, I think that in the old days it was quite sufficient just to be an actor, but I think nowadays people demand slightly more. You need to be an ambassador and a model and a DJ and I don't know, lots of other things where I just like to do what I do.
And you've been lucky enough in being able to work without having to do that too much of that. I mean, I know you're having to do it now for Ballyturk and, you know, you have to do a certain amount of red carpet and all the rest. But you've been lucky enough that the work seems to have come your way reasonably well.
Yeah, I mean, I have. And, you know, I've re-collaborated. Like, this is the third time I've worked with Enda, and I've been lucky to keep that working relationship going. And, you know, I'm very keen to, I've always been keen to spread the work across cinema and theatre and television, because for me it's just about following the good writing. It's not necessarily the medium, you know.
Actually, last thing I saw you in was Peaky Blinder on the BBC, which was great. I really enjoyed that series.
Good.
It looked like you enjoyed making it as well.
I did. It was brilliant writing, and we've just actually finished shooting the second season of that. And, you know, there's a very interesting thing happening in television at this point in time. I think the quality of the writing is amazing, and there's a lot of migration, I think, from film to television as a result of that.
And Peaky Blinder, it's a bit like Ripper Street meets Gangs of New York, for anyone who hasn't seen it. It's kind of a noirish Victorian gangland, and you're one of the gang guys, but an interesting guy, and a guy we're probably more interested in than Sam Neill, the detective, who's really bad. And so the morality of the thing is quite mixed, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it interesting, you know. And I've always been interested in characters that have that sort of duality or that sort of contradiction with them or that ambiguity. To me, that's interesting, because we all walk around like that as human beings, I think. And what's happening in television is that sort of long form drama where you get to spend time with the character for like 6 to 12 hours is amazing, because people invest heavily in these characters, and it's like the sort of the televisual equivalent of the novel, I think, these days. And it's an exciting time.
And your second series of that will be coming up soon, is that right?
Yeah, and I think it comes out in the autumn.
Yeah, I look forward to that. And you've a movie coming out next year already. There's talk about Oscar nominations and all the rest, which I presume, or Oscar speculation, the Moby Dick movie,
Heart of the Sea. Yeah.
Heart of the Sea. You had to starve yourself for that.
Well, yeah, a little bit. It's the story that inspired Melville to write Moby Dick. It's a true story about this whaling ship that left Nantucket back in like 1820, I think, and then they got stove by this white whale, and the whaleboat sank, and then they had to survive in these. The ship sank, and they had to survive in these whaleboats. So yeah, that's the story, and there was necessarily we had to look
Bit skinny in the whaleboat.
yeah. So that wasn't that brilliant.
Well, you're not exactly large to start with, so
no.
It can't have been easy.
No, going to bed hungry is not something I recommend to anybody. It's not a very pleasant feeling. But you know, hopefully it. And you know, the film isn't about that. You know, but it's a much bigger story. But, you know.
And the fact that, you know, there's all this, and again, you've been associated with a lot of awards and nominations, and there is this Oscar speculation already about this movie that hasn't come out yet. Again, that fuss about awards, that kind of attention, to some people it matters enormously. I'm getting the impression that you would probably run a million miles from it, would you?
No, I don't. I mean, it's, the thing is, you don't do the work for that stuff. And it's very arbitrary, and you have no control over it. But it's nice when people say nice things about the film, and it's nice if people get interested in it, wins an award. That's a lovely thing. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have that confirmation of work, you know.
And the balance between, say, blockbusters and indie movies or theatres, do you do all that very consciously? Do you think, I want to spread my wings more there, or I'll do something like a Batman in order to do, you know, something more way out?
To be honest with you, no, I've never had a plan as clever as that. It's just been, right, that seems like a good script, and that seems like a good script, and the budget really is immaterial, because the budget is only like the amount of resources the director has, and it's how he utilises those resources. And, you know, you can squander a small budget as much as you can squander a large one. So to me, no, it's I have no plan. I really just stumble from one thing to the next, just purely based on, I think this may be a good story. I think this may be a good story.
What about writing or music or directing yourself?
You know, I'm still very passionate about music, and it's very important to me. And yeah, directing, it's sort of it's not a burning desire. It's a kind of a faint itch that I'd like mm-hmm. to explore sometime. They say, you know, the story needs to find you, and if there's something that you absolutely have to make, then that may happen. But at the moment, I'm very happy acting. I'm very mm-hmm. happy. You know, I think I've more to prove to myself, and I've another 10 years to make that good actor, as I said.
10 years, is that what
you're
giving yourself?
30 years. I'm doing it 20, so I'll come back to you in 10. We'll see how I'm doing.
We'll do the interview then. when you approach a part, are you one of these kind of method people that, you know, gets totally absorbed in it, and your wife and your kids have to kind of back off a bit, or are you quite a technical actor who can just switch it on and off? You know.
Yeah, I don't know. It sort of depends on the role. You know, some characters, it's a lot. You have to go quite a long journey from yourself, and naturally you need to do the research, and naturally you have to take that journey. And then others, it's a sort of a slight adjustment. So, and I think the method really is it's kind of overused and sort of misunderstood. I think it's more about it's like how you get to that performance.
Have you trained as an actor?
No. No, theatre was really kind of where I kind of began to figure
out. You kind of learned on the job.
Kind of, yeah.
Because you were doing law initially. You went to UCC to do law, isn't that right?
Briefly, yeah.
Briefly. The first year exams didn't quite work out,
did they not? It didn't work out too well. It was I failed gloriously, yeah. Yeah, it was just a slight misstep, I think, along the road.
And in trying to talk to your parents at that stage, because, you know, as a parent, people worry so much about their kids and the directions, you know, they're looking for in life. Mm-hmm. Your parents were both teachers. So when you were morphing from failed law student into walking away from a record deal into, no, I'm going to go for the theatre now. Were they scratching their heads? Were they supportive?
I think, you know, because I'm the oldest of four, so I think naturally it was a little scary for them at that time. But they've been brilliant, and we really like love it, and they are always there at the shows, and yeah, and you know, I understand now as a parent that it's tough, you know, and you hope that they're making the right decision, but you'll never really know, and I realise the thing as well that you're always a parent, it never stops.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah, I've a lot of understanding for what they went through and what, you know. So.
I know you keep thinking there's a stage when you'll know what'll happen, but then there's another stage that you've got to learn, and it goes on and on and on from there. The Leaving Cert, I've read some comments from you where you spoke about how traumatised you were by The Leaving Cert. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the amount of pressure that's, I don't know if it still exists, but certainly in my day, the amount of pressure around The Leaving Cert and points and all of that,
it still exists.
Yeah, well, it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. And it's really not a representation of how clever or intelligent or talented or whatever you may be. It's just this scramming and then, you know, regurgitating facts.
And maybe a lot of what went wrong with the law, apart from everything else, you know, that you'd other desires, was sometimes I think people go to college and after all that effort for the Leaving Cert, they're just burnt out.
Well, that's it, exactly. And then you have to start right up again, back into the same system. And I found that sort of galling to have 2 months off and then go straight back into it again. Yeah, so I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the alternative is. But yeah, I found it very stressful.
And how do you find English schools, watching your kids going to school there compared with our education system here?
Well, I think, you know, we've chosen a school that's quite laid back and relaxed, and I know the kids kind of they learn at their own pace, and I think that to me seems like the right approach. Whether or not it is, I guess I'll find out. But you know, that it just seems
the pressure point in England tends to be do they still have that 11 plus or that separation
at the
end of primary?
They do.
That's really the grading thing here, separation thing there, isn't it? The way that the leaving is the separation thing for us, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I don't think a 10-year-old should be put under pressure again to display his or her sort of abilities. It's just, it's counterintuitive to me. Yeah. You know, learning should be just about in having fun and expressing yourself as a child, and that system isn't. And I know they have to have some way of doing it, but they just seem. Seems wrong to me, yeah.
And you're involved with UNESCO. You've an interest, I think, in kind of the, is it, I suppose, the dilemmas, the pressures for young men these days.
Yeah, and I'm involved in UNESCO and in the university in Galway, and I do a little bit of work for them, and you know, in this very low key way. But yeah, man, what I love about their work is that it's about empowering the kids. Like the kids are the researchers, and that's I think a very intelligent thing. Again, it just seems like common sense that the kids should inform us about how they're feeling rather than us telling them how they're feeling. You know.
But I get the sense that that's the kind of encounter and discussion you really do enjoy more than kind of things when it's, you know, you're put on the spot and it's all about you and somebody mentions your eyes, you know, and you get sick of it and all the rest.
Who likes talking about themselves? You know, it's weird, but.
Well, our callers like talking about you. There's a couple here. Breakfast on Pluto is one of our callers' favourite films. How does Cillian feel about it now? And what do you think happened to the character Kitten?
I loved that character. One of the characters I fell in love with, you know, very deeply. And
I mean, even before you got to play it, clearly.
Yes, well, as I said, I loved the novel and I love Pat McCabe's work. And yeah, I have great affection for the character and I hope that she's doing all right somewhere.
Tell Cillian he's a wonderful actor and to relish in the fact that great looks are the icing on the cake. So there you go. And this caller's family is looking forward to seeing Cillian in the Black Box next month, including her son Connor or his son. It's from Claire O'Dwyer and Galway, so her son Connor, who aspires to acting himself. I know there was one quote I saw when you were talking to the kids in Galway and they were asking you about acting and you were saying, persevere. That's the.
Yeah, you know, keep on keeping on. That's what I think, and always have fun. And you know, the thing that's great about nowadays is kids can make films like on their phones and upload it to YouTube, and you know, there's technology has allowed us to do these things now. And so I would always just keep making stuff. And you know, as long as you're making, you're creating and you're involved in it, then that's good for your head, I think.
Yeah, and you can put it out there. You don't have to be mediated by an agent or a record label or whatever.
No, make your own, make it happen for yourself, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Really, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
Much.
And the listeners have certainly enjoyed listening to you. So Ballyturk coming up at the Galway Arts Festival and then in August at the Olympia and then Cork Opera House and then it'll be moving on to the National Theatre in London. And we can see you normal-sized and skinny coming up in that movie in the spring. And thanks a million, Cillian Murphy, for coming in to us. We'll be back with more after this break.